Here's a pioneer. Once again, one of the pioneer transportation firms of Interior Alaska, the Pioneer Cab Company, is pleased to bring you 15 minutes of remembrance. Joe Coble and the Pioneer Cab staff hope you'll enjoy the following interview with a genuine old-timer. His name is C.J. Woofter, and he's here chiefly to tell the story of early-day radio communication in Alaska. Mr. Woofter, what year did you choose to come to Alaska?
I came to Alaska in 1905, landing in Fairbanks on the 4th of July of that year.
And will you tell us what made you decide to come north?
Well, an old schoolmate of mine had been in Alaska, and he had told me so much about Alaska that I decided to come here and take advantage of the easy money he told me about and save enough money to finish my education at Cornell University.
What was your home down in the States?
My home was Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Will you tell us something of the means of transportation and the route you chose to get to Alaska?
We came from Seattle to St. Michael by steamship, then up the Yukon River by large packet, and we changed from that at Tanana or Fort Gibbon to a smaller packet and came to Fairbanks.
Did you come to Fairbanks as a civilian or with the Army?
No, I was a member of the United States Signal Corps.
Uh-huh. Will you tell us something of the early equipment that the Signal Corps used here in Alaska in those days? First, perhaps, we'd better begin by asking you, where was the first radio transmitter set up in Alaska?
There were five of them built in 1906. Eagle, Circle, Fairbanks, Fort Gibbon, and Nome. These stations were built chiefly to bridge line breaks in the old Washington-Alaska military telegraph and cable system, which was the means of communication then.
Will you tell us something of that cable system? I understand at one time that they intended to put a telegraph line clear over to Russia. Is that correct?
Well, that was long before my time. That is correct, however, but tremendous difficulties in engineering and the tremendous cost deterred the people from building at the time, and the U.S. Signal Corps has furnished Alaska all the communication it has had up to the present time.
Will you tell us where the first radio transmitter was located?
The first in Fairbanks, you mean?
No, the first radio transmitter in the territory of Alaska.
The first two transmitters in the territory of Alaska were situated at St. Michael and Safety Harbor. Their purpose was to bridge, to jump across Norden Bay to save building a telegraph line several hundred miles around the loop. And incidentally, at this point, I'd like to say that these two stations operated by the United States Signal Corps were the first two successfully operated commercial wireless stations in the world.
I imagine that spark gap equipment was used in those days before the vacuum tube?
That's correct. All the stations were spark gap equipment up until, I think, 1913 or 14, perhaps, were our first tube transmissions.
Will you tell us something of your experiences as an early day operator? What did the equipment look like, and what were some of the difficulties that you had to overcome?
Well, there were quite a number of difficulties. The equipment used at that time would not be identified as radio equipment by a radio operator using modern equipment. One piece of equipment I remember was our condenser rack at this station here in 1906, 7, and 8. Which consisted of 298 Leyden jars. They were glass jars about 18 inches long, about 2 inches in diameter, lined inside and covered outside with tin foil with a variable connection on the bottom for varying the capacity of the condenser. One whole side of the transmitting room was covered with these Leyden jars, and their capacity was so feeble that one could carry a condenser in his coat pocket now that would have as much capacity as the Leyden jar one I'm describing now.
My earlier conversation with you convinces me that it even took some physical hardship to transmit in those days. By that, I mean the lack of ventilation. Will you review that again, please?
Yes, another thing that is recalled to my memory is that our transmitter room here was soundproofed. We had a 4-inch wall built inside of the room, packed with mineral wool. It was absolutely airtight. And the old open spark gaps would burn up the oxygen in the air very quickly, and the odor was very offensive. We called it ozone. And after a half an hour to an hour in a sealed room, one would be pretty dizzy. Later on, we hit on a scheme of cutting a hole through the floor and putting the spark gap under the floor so that we wouldn't get the offensive odor from it.
You told me, too, about the possibility of a private here in the Signal Corps having made some important discovery in connection with transmission with the, as you called it, I believe, Audion tube?
Yes. That was about 1911. His name was James V. Winchester, lovingly known all over the service as Foxy Winchester. Incidentally, he was 15 years a trap drummer with Ringling Brothers Circus, but he was an excellent telegrapher. In 1911, I think it was, they sent out to each one of the wireless stations in Alaska a tube detector known as the Audion detector. Before that time, the wireless operators had been using crystal detectors, silicon, paracon, carborundum, and other materials, which were certainly not good detectors. This tube was a wonderful improvement over the old mineral detectors, but with these detectors came a directive from the Signal Corps Laboratory in Washington that they were not to be opened up, not to be tampered with, and that whoever was caught tampering with these detectors would be summarily dealt with, which was only an invitation for our friend Foxy Winchester to take one of them apart. And while he was playing with it, he happened to be working on a receiver on the other side of the room, and he found out that he could send out a signal with this detector tube the same as he could receive one. And he was willing to take punishment for having disobeyed orders, and he wrote it up to the officer in charge, who in turn transmitted it to the Bureau of Standards in Washington through the Signal Corps Laboratory. And the next year, the Signal Corps in Alaska was furnished with their first tube transmitters. Now, whether Winchester's discovery had anything to do with tube transmission, I don't know, but it followed almost immediately.
Well, it would sound logical, all right. I wonder if there are any interesting stories in regard to messages that you, as an early day operator, had to get through.
Well, yes, there were so many of them that it's a little difficult to fix on any one particular one, but I think one of the most interesting radio experiences I had was in connection with Sam Dubin, an old-timer of this district who used to be a merchant here, but who at this particular time had a trading post at Alatna and Wiseman. One afternoon, he was filling a Coleman gasoline lantern, and it exploded, and the burning gasoline burnt him very severely on his hands and face and burnt his clothes off of him. And I happened to be tuning. I happened to be chief operator at the radio station in Fairbanks, and I was tuning that afternoon, and I was tuning from Point Barrow down to Livengood. And in doing so, I crossed Wiseman's frequency, and Wiseman was calling wildly and occasionally sending out SOS. So I broke in to see what was wrong, talked to the operator up there, and found out that Sam Dubin had had this serious accident, and they wanted an airplane to come up and pick him up as quickly as possible. So I contacted one of the local flying firms. We had a plane in the air in about 27 minutes, and Sam was brought in the next morning. They couldn't make the trip that evening, but he was lodged in the hospital here next morning, and his attending physician said that certainly if he hadn't been brought in at that particular time, that they wouldn't have been able to save his life. Sam lived quite a few years after that, but was horribly disfigured from the fire.
Also, I believe you told us something of flying in regard to weather observation and use of the radio telephone.
Yes, I'm reminded that Harold Gillam, one of the old-time outstanding flyers of this district, had a contract with the Weather Bureau to make flights an elevation of 20,000 feet. The U.S. Signal Corps had the only radio telephone in Fairbanks, except an old phone that Harold had partially built and installed in his plane. It was an extremely cold winter, and on several instances, Harold would get off the ground in perfectly clear weather, but after he got up to an elevation of 20,000 feet, the smoke would settle on the ground till he couldn't see the field, couldn't land. We didn't have marking lights then as we have now, and many times we brought him down with our radio telephone. We'd look out the window of the Federal Building and send back to him, say, Harold, you're north of the Federal Building, or you're south of the Federal Building. Fly a little east or west, or however the case may be, and many times we brought him in, when otherwise he wouldn't have been able to land.
Perhaps that was one of the earliest instances of talking an airplane down, which is frequently exercised these days. How many years did you serve with the Signal Corps in Alaska, Mr. Woofter?
Altogether, 28 years of my service was with the Signal Corps in Alaska.
Where were you when World War II was declared?
I was operator in charge at Fairbanks at the time. Had a detail of about 15 men, as I remember it.
You were later commissioned, weren't you?
Yes, I was commissioned on the 1st of June, 1942, and was a commissioned officer from that time until December of 1945, when I was overtaken by the age limit and gave up my commission and re-enlisted as a master sergeant to finish up my 30 years.
And it's my understanding that you've taken a keen interest in local civic affairs. Will you tell us something about that?
Yes, it's been my pleasure and my honor to have been rather active in civic affairs. I was a number of years intimately connected with the American Legion here, during which time I was their representative on your local Chamber of Commerce and was a member of their executive committee. I belonged to all of the lodges in the town, and I'm a former member of your Alaska legislature, having served in the ninth session in 1929.
Well, Mr. Woofter, you are truly an old-time radio man. I wonder what you think are the prospects in regard to communication in the territory of Alaska. What about the future of communication up here?
The communication service, so far as the Signal Corps is concerned, while I'm no longer a member of it, I can certainly speak for them, will improve. As soon as a new piece of equipment comes on the market, is sent to Alaska to get the bugs taken out of it, and the ACS men up here certainly know how to do it. So your communication in Alaska, as long as the ACS handles it, will continue to improve and become better and better as the years grow by.
All right, and thank you, Mr. C.J. Woofter. Friends, you've listened to Here's a Pioneer, the weekly 15-minute broadcast that brings before the microphone one of Alaska's early day pioneers who helped to make history in the territory. Each Wednesday evening at 7:30, the Pioneer Cab Company, an old-timer among Fairbanks businesses, brings you this 15 minutes of radio recollection. Joe Coble and the Pioneer Cab Company invite you to listen to Here's a Pioneer again next week. 7:30 on a Wednesday evening is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a program brought to you every week at this time by the Pioneer Cab Company, operated by Joe Coble. The telephone number is East 10A. And this week we have with us in the studio a man who is on the verge of going outside with no particular interest in returning except for an occasional vacation. He certainly has spent a long time in the Northland. His name is Mr. Al Coslett. Now, I believe that Al is known to hundreds and hundreds of you. And Al, the first question that I would like to put to you is, how old are you?
I'm 76.
You're a 76-year-old member of the Pioneers of Alaska, and what year did you come north?
1897.
What was your home state down south?
I was born in Colorado, and then I came from Wyoming to Alaska.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you decided to come north?
About 27, I believe.
27. And you left Seattle, I presume, by boat?
Yes, we left on the old Topeka.
Mm-hmm. And where did you settle when you came up here first?
Well, I settled in, the winter of 97 and spring of 98 in Skagway.
Did you know anyone up here before you came? Did you have any connections in Alaska?
Well, I had a brother in Skagway.
Mm-hmm. What sort of a business did you engage in Skagway?
I ran a restaurant there.
I imagine you were busy then supplying a lot of the miners and prospectors, people who were there to go on up over the pass.
Oh, yes.
How about the prices of meals in those days? How did they compare with what we have today?
They were about 50 cents a meal there, and regular meals were about 50 cents.
Anything special would be just
a little over, yes. Something not like over a dollar or something like that.
I see. Were the prices well received? Was 50 cents regarded
as high?
Well,
some of them thought it was pretty high.
Mm-hmm. Well, how long did you stay in the restaurant business?
Till long about spring. I don't know just when we closed the restaurant. I sold out then, and I shipped in horses from Wyoming, and then later on I sold the horses there, and later on I sent to Seattle and got some big teams, five big teams.
What did you intend to do with them up here?
Well, we were freighting there. And then I sold the team, three teams, and I kept two teams and came over the Dalton Trail to Five Finger Rapids.
Did you have any particular difficulties going over the Dalton Trail?
None whatever.
How about down through Five Finger Rapids?
Well, we didn't go through the rapids. We went over the trail, the Dalton Trail, and we landed just below Five Finger Rapids. And then there was a sawmill there, and one of our party was a sawyer, and so we contracted to put in logs there, and we made $10,000 in less than 2 months.
I bet you thought you were really in the land of big money.
Yeah.
How come you didn't stay with that for a while?
Well, of course, there was a demand for lumber because they were shipping in cattle and beef down to Dawson, and as soon as they were supplied by the demand for lumber was over.
It all stopped then.
Yeah.
Well, where did you go after you got out of the logging and sawmill business?
Well, we built a raft and went down and floated down as far as Fort Selkirk. And, I bought everything from the partners, and I took over. And then we sold our lumber to the Canadian government. They were building a post there. They had a post there. And then I bought a bunch of sheep. Mm-hmm. A fellow was short of money, and I bought part of his sheep. And then we loaded them on the steamer Terrell, and we were out just a short time, and we hit a sandbar, and we was on there for about 20 days. And I killed the sheep and then sold them to the steamship company, and then took a scow and took my one horse that I had left and floated into Dawson. Got in there the 18th of October.
I see your outfit was pretty well trimmed down by the time you got to Dawson.
Yeah, that's all I have.
What did you do around Dawson?
Oh, I prospected during the winter on Bear Creek. Didn't find anything, and then worked in the different places and worked in the meat markets there and in the restaurants. And then I ran a roadhouse up on Bonanza Creek, and I sold it. One of the men I sold to is here. That's Billy O'Leary.
Oh, yes.
And after I sold, why then, when the spring of the excitement of 1902 over this strike in here, why, in the spring of 1903, why, I started in here with two horses.
Then, Al, you are one of those who followed the word of the Jap, Wada, who came over to Dawson and said that
a rich strike had been made in this area.
Yes.
Well, Fairbanks in 1903, I believe that you are the earliest one to come to Fairbanks that I've ever talked to. I don't think I'm wrong about that. What was it like here?
Oh, well, it was just a town of tents and stumps, and it was pretty hard to get along First Street there on account of stumps.
Stumps and maybe a lot of mud, too.
Yeah.
What do you suppose was the population when you
winter came? When I got here.
Winter.
Oh, it was hard. There was 10,000 people here, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe more.
But in 1903, how many do you think there was?
They were coming in all the time. It was pretty hard to judge what the population was. They were divided pretty well between the town of Chena and Fairbanks. Of course, Chena, at the mouth of the Chena River here, they were trying to get the town built there.
I see. What was the terrain like here? I understand it was rather heavily wooded.
Oh, yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
I was on Clary when that fire burned through there the first time, and that was all heavy timber through there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, where did you pitch your tent?
Why, about the first tent, about where the Nordale Hotel is, I think.
That's unbelievable now. That's been a long time, 44 years.
Yeah.
And what were some of the first buildings here in town?
Well, Captain Barnett had a building. That was his trading post. Well,
that's the NC company now. That's
where the NC company is now. That same building is the NC is still using.
I see.
And then there was Petrie had the Pioneer, which is the same building they had at that time. And then there was a Senate. The Senate Saloon was running when we came here, or shortly after I came. And there were very few buildings around.
There was a sawmill here too, wasn't there?
Well, that came in after. We passed that sawmill on the trail.
It was on the move then.
It was coming from. It came up the good pasture, up the 40 mile, and down the good pasture. And it was Carroll and Parker. Fred Parker is still here. Carroll, I believe, has passed away. And they were running it. That was running where Pete Malone had his store, right back in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Were there some industrious women in the community at that time?
Well, yes. There was one that worked there for Carroll and Parker. And her husband, he was kind of a... He didn't care very much for work.
And we'd better not mention his name.
Oh, no, we'll... And at any rate, she had made arrangements so that she was getting $100 a month and boarding his board and her board and sleeping apartments. And so one morning, she said to him, "Jim," she says, "won't you get up and start a fire for me?" He says, "No, I won't. He says, "Suppose the two of us are going to work here for $100 a month?"
It just couldn't be a good deal. Well, I imagine there was no organized charity in those early days. How did you take care of different
people? Oh, well, of course, when anyone was sick, someone started a petition. We went around and collected the money.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of just how...
Well, there was one little case on Esther, and I've often wondered that someone didn't say something about it before. But there was a man who was killed in a drift over there, and so after his body was taken out of the mine, why, they went to look through his effects to see where his folks lived, and looking through was a letter from his wife. And in that letter was a little baby stocking. This little baby had been born since he left. And as soon as they discovered that baby stocking, Mrs. Fred Parker was there, and she said, "Give that stocking to me." Well, they asked her what she was going to do with it. She said, "I'm going to fill it with gold." And she took that baby stocking, and it was filled with gold, more than... They had to sew it to keep it together.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a good many bills besides that. And I don't know how much money they got out of that. baby stocking.
Well, I guess that dates back to the beginning of the Golden Heart of Alaska, for sure.
I guess it is. Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that there was a serious flu epidemic, not as early as we've mentioned so far, but...
Well, that was happened just before the First World War, and it didn't strike Livingood quite as soon as it struck Fairbanks and Enana. But in Livingood, everyone had the flu, and we had no doctor there. And I had organized the Chamber of Commerce of Livingood, and they elected me president. And after I could get away, everyone's closed their stores, and after I could get away, my wife was very sick at that time, I went down to Bill Mahon's store, and I told him, we have to have a doctor here. Well, someone suggested one doctor, but I said, no, I said, we'll send for Dr. Sutherland. And I says, I know that he'll come. Well, Dr. Sutherland, I consider one of the greatest men that was ever in Alaska.
I think there are hundreds and hundreds who'd agree with you on that.
And it made no difference where you called to him. He didn't ask who or what they were, whether they had any money or anything. He said, just where are they? And he went. We had to hire a dog team or a pack outfit or any way that he could get there. And he brought many an old fella in here that he never got a dollar for.
Is that right?
And so when I sent a wire and they had a wireless station there, and I sent a wire to Dr. Sutherland, and I got a wire in less than an hour on my way, and meet me at the log jam with dog team. Well, I sent a team. Jack Irwin took his team and went to meet him. Well, he came there. Well, the doctor never stopped until he had treated every person in a cabin or anywhere that was sick that he could find. Well, there was a lot of Indians over there, so they were down with the flu. So he took a fellow by the name of Frank Bowers, another wonderful fellow, and they went over there, and some of the Indians, well, the bucks were sitting around and making the squaws do the work, but Frank Bowers took a club and went after the bucks and made them get out and rustle wood. And so when the old doctor came back, he told me that, he said, there's two people, he says, I don't believe I can save. And he was right. They died with pneumonia and were buried in Livingood.
Well, I can understand that Dr. Sutherland would certainly deserve a lot of credit. I just have a second or two here. I forgot to ask you one point about that charity business. Sometimes weren't there cases of misdirected charity?
Well, yes, we had one fellow we took up $1,500 for.
What did he do with it?
He went out and started the saloon.
Well, we'll have to make that the parting shot, Mr. Al Coslett. Friends, you've listened to an interview with Al Coslett, who first came to Alaska in 1897 and is now in a few days leaving for the outside. Here's a Pioneer is brought to you each Wednesday evening at 7:30 by the Pioneer Cab Company, located across from the Nordale Hotel, and their telephone number is East 10A. Be with us again next week, same time, for another program of Here's a Pioneer.
Luminous prospect, just what we picked up. In fact, the native showed us this rock, and they could see the gold in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Joe, I know that we do not have enough time to retrace all of your travelings throughout the North and all of the things you've accomplished, but I particularly would like to know about some of the long and arduous trips that you've made up here in the North Country.
Well, that was one trip. They went from day after we got a bird. I made one long trip right across the country, back towards the, I think just about where they're drilling the oil well there, at the mouth of the Anaktuvik.
Umiat?
Umiat, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I made another long trip, that one I made from Nome in 1900 with the rowboat from Nome into Sismayef Inlet up the Serpentine River to the hot springs.
In a rowboat? How long was that? How far?
Oh, I figured about 250 miles up there.
I don't think I'd like to row that far.
And well, the only way we could get there was no steamers. And then I had another long trip I made up then up to Stikine in the spring of 1912.
Stikine comes out somewhere
down at Wrangell. Yeah, I went up there with two dogs, and that's an awful country to go up there. It's a snowshoe 160 miles, and when I got there, I just kept on going for another outfit to look up some coal fields up there, another 240 miles. I took an Indian with me that time.
That makes a 400-mile trip on snowshoes.
Yeah, and then I had another big long trip there, the one I made the last trip into the Kobuk, and then that was about 1,400 miles. Mm-hmm. And I had an Eskimo going across the Portage.
I see.
And I snowshoed 900 miles of that. Uh-huh. I had to measure the distance. I had a bicycle wheel to see how far it was.
I see. Yeah. Well, that certainly makes very interesting reading and listening material. And Joe, now I'd like to know something about the Alaska of the present. You've certainly covered so much of the Northland. You must have some ideas about what's being done that's wrong right now and what kind of a future this country has. Understand that right in our listening audience, we have many newcomers who are interested in really making a go of this country. What do you think are the possibilities along that line?
Well, what we need new blood, you know. The old times is getting too old. They outlive their usefulness. They're done as far as they're concerned.
And well, I understand that about six outfits a day are coming in over the highway. Don't you think we're getting the new blood?
Well, that's what they need, but if they got to be educated and told just in the possibilities and how to go about it, you know. You got to help them out in the best way you know how, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the mineral future of Alaska?
Well, the mineral future, I was always interested in that, you know. We have the greatest possibilities here for mineral, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, the gold is still the principal item.
You don't think it's all worked out?
Why, no, heck no. There's thousands of square miles. Right today, I know, and we've got all kinds of other minerals. We've got nickel, we've got tin, mm-hmm. we've got all those, but it's just to go and look for it. Mm-hmm. But we never looked for it.
Do you feel that the era of the prospector is sort of dying out?
Well, it's just kind of a lull, you see. The main heist of what was here, see, the hundreds that used to prospect here, there's only probably about 2% left mm-hmm. that's doing any real prospecting.
Well, don't you think the airplane is opening things up?
Well, the airplane is open to get there, but to prospect, you got to be on the ground. After you find the place where you got it, then get your airplane in there and all your stuff in there, no.
You got to walk up those creek beds and
you
got to
go down and take your pick and hammer the rock and see what kind of looking rock you got there. Mm-hmm. And the future of this Alaska mining is the quartz, the hard rock. Mm-hmm. Something permanent that you can work all year round. Because mm-hmm. the plaster is still, won't be now. You take the Circle County over there, now that's 55 years ago when that was discovered. Mm-hmm. And they're still mining, and they'll be mining there for the next 20 years.
Well, what part of Alaska do you think really has the greatest future?
Well, that all depends of what the resources are.
Let me put that differently. Yeah. What part of Alaska do you think stands the greatest chance of increasing its population?
Well, that depends on the development of the certain resource. Now, we got a great fishing resource, which that isn't developed properly either, you know.
You think not?
Oh, no. There's a lot of fishing, the scrap fish and all that stuff can be put up there. Mm. Now, another thing is your pulp, you know.
Oh, yes.
Industry. Now, I know of a place down in Ketchikan at 17, a fella built a lake up there to put in a pulp mill. Now, that's 30 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Well, he really had some foresight.
Well, he had, and the lake is still there, and this Mr. Heinzelmann, Frank, he just came to country when I was at the forum. Mm-hmm. He'd been trying to do something. Well, that's the future for Southeastern Alaska is a pulp mill. And your timber and your fish. Mm-hmm. And ours in here, of course, we're doing quite a bit of farming. And there'll be more farming going on, especially what I figure on be down at the Copper River Valley, you know, mm-hmm. east of Matanuska. There's a great chance in there for farming. Mm-hmm. And if we can get the population in here and the people get enough farm there, we can raise enough here to accept certain things we have to import, you know. But I think we can get by very well there.
Well, Joe, this season marks your 50th year in Alaska.
Yeah, yeah.
How can you honestly say that you've enjoyed it? You had it to live over again in the States?
I wouldn't take $1 million for it.
Uh-huh. All right.
I said, well, you know, I'm perfectly satisfied, and I tell you, It's not that a fellow sometimes says getting the money, but it's the self-satisfaction you get out of the life in Alaska. You know? Mm.
I think I can understand that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you ever so much, Joe Ulmer. We've certainly enjoyed having you visit us, come all the way down from Circle, and we've enjoyed having you on the presentation Here's a Pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
You've listened to a talk with Joe Ulmer, who first came to the North in 1897. Here's a Pioneer is brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company, located across from the Nordale Hotel, telephone number East 10A. This presentation, an interview with one of Alaska's genuine old-timers, is heard each Wednesday evening at 7:30.